It's the New Books and Food Podcast.
Hi, it's Alan Salkin from New Books and Food. I'm talking to Margarita Martinez, who is not the author of, but is the person talking about, a book called The Cabot Creamery Cookbook, Simple Wholesome Dishes from America's Best Dairy Farms. And there's also a weird little red sort of embossed fake sticker on it that says Cooking with Award-Winning Cheeses, Butters, and Yogurts. Hi.
Hello.
So what's your, are you just a hired hand to do PR for the book, or do you work with Cabot, or what's your story?
Well, this is my first collaboration with Cabot. So they and Time Inc. Oxmoor House Books, who published the book, contacted me after being familiar with my work on television with Food and Travel in New England. And they asked if I would write an intro letter and submit some sandwich recipes and also be the spokesperson. So when I found out it was Cabot, I've grown up with Cabot. It's always been a pantry staple in my home, and I just love what they do and the cooperative and everything about it. So I was really excited to get on board.
So do you have recipes in the book?
I do. I have two sandwich recipes. One is a Monterey Jack guava and arugula sandwich. And that one is kind of my savory take on guava cheese puffs, which is something that I grew up around the house all the time. And then I have a grilled cheese with apple, red onion, and apricot jam, and also some Dijon mustard. So that's another sandwich I have in there.
Guava?
Mm-hmm.
Did you grow up in Hawaii?
No. I'm Puerto Rican, and Puerto Ricans have a tendency to eat guava, sliced guava paste, with queso blanco, which is a white cheese, most similar, I would think, would be Monterey Jack that you could get here. And you would have it as a little snack with café con leche. It's very popular. So it's not just Hawaiian, but also the tropics in the Caribbean. It's very popular, and in South America as well.
Does guava grow in Puerto Rico?
Mm-hmm. It does.
I'm looking at the grilled cheese with red onion, apple, and apricot jam recipe. So, but let me ask you this: this is because I write about.com site about cookbooks and food writing, and I'm interested in your relationship and how this works. Because so you are you've done food on TV, food travel segments, or tell me your biography in terms of that.
Sure, I hosted the show Neighborhood Kitchens, which was a show produced by WGBH, which is the PBS network out of Boston.
Right, and the one that produces most of the famous food content that's starting with Julia Child.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Right, exactly. So there's a long heritage. So it was really neat for me to be a part of that kind of heritage with working with WGBH and the productions that they have done of with food television. So with Neighborhood Kitchens is a show that I went around to different New England neighborhoods and talked about how they've changed over the years. And then I would go into a restaurant and the chefs would share three of their dishes. And it was how they shared their culture with the patrons of their restaurants. And that could either be in their Brazilian restaurant, their Senegalese restaurant, or working in the Bristol Lounge of the Four Seasons and how that person is introducing their food from El Salvador into the menu. So so that's kind of the work that I was doing in that television show. So that's how
How did the show get distributed? How many other PBS networks or channels picked it up?
It was on the one based out of Worcester, like in Central Mass, and then on out of Boston. So if you have cable in basically all over New England, then you can have access. It'll be on a different channel other than Channel 2, which it is in Boston. But, you know, Rhode Island would have it as long as you had cable as well. So that it kind of went all over, and all the episodes are archived online, and we have a blog and a webpage there. And it's also, if you go to PBS, if you go to PBS.com, you can find it all archived up there because they have shows from all over the country from PBS.
Well, that's the region where Food Network started, actually, out of the Providence cable, then the Providence cable provider in 93, Colony Cable, which ran a lot of the, had a station in Worcester and all throughout that area. And they were the ones that dreamt up Food Network. And then, obviously, it still exists.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's very fertile. You wouldn't think New England would be so food entertainment fertile, but it is.
Mm-hmm.
People probably don't realize that the way – there is no such thing kind of as PBS. There's a whole bunch of networks that are very loosely affiliated, and each of which can choose – to run any PBS programming or almost none of it if they want. So
right.
The way that a lot of food shows are done is that one, basically the person who wants to produce the show, the person who, even who wants to star in the show, has to raise money from any source pretty much and then get a local PBS channel, affiliated channel, to sponsor it, and then it goes into this pool and any other PBS channel can run it. Am I right?
Yes, that is true. And then it gets approval, and that's sometimes how it works. With Neighborhood Kitchens, we were actually developed by an in-house producer, Patricia Alvarado, and so she came up with the concept, and it was done under La Plaza, which is a branch of WGBH that had been around for 35 years, which is multicultural programming. So we were actually internal, but a lot of people, I mean, for instance, In the Mind of a Chef with Anthony Bourdain's production company, I mean, he came, and then PBS produces it. And like you said, it depends on which affiliates want to pick it up and want to have it on their network. And even I used to live in Providence, and what's interesting is that in Providence, you know, you think of the classic masterpiece shows that come on Sunday evenings,
right,
and those wouldn't
right.
be on Rhode Island. Rhode Island would choose to have different programming because they felt, I'm assuming they felt that, well, you know, other people can also get Channel 2 and get WGBH, so they have that. So you can, there's also other affiliates that decide to have their programming on at different times, things like that.
Yes, it's a different model. It's more complicated than people think, although it also does kind of allow for brilliant entrepreneurs to get a PBS show when, when otherwise it might not be possible. I have to point out also that the guy that started Food Network in Providence had also started foreign language channels. That was really all, the most experience he had. He had started a Portuguese channel because there's a lot of Portuguese immigrants up in that area.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, so there's a whole history of obviously, you know, ethnic, you know, foreign cuisine and the Great American Melting Pot and food. It all kind of fits together. All right. So, but the reason I'm on this whole line, and we're not talking about Cabot yet, and we will, is that what interests me especially is this sort of piece of the business where I don't know if do you know Sissy Biggers.
That name sounds familiar. Yes,
Sissy.
She is a host on Food Network.
She was a host on Food Network,
yes.
And she, but she also now kind of is somebody that gets hired to like go on the Today Show and talk about a brand because the Today Show producers may be comfortable with Sissy. They know her, and so if a brand has a new, you know, what do you call it? A new immersion blender coming out, and they want somebody to sort of chat about it and demonstrate it on TV, and they don't have great in-house people, they'll hire Sissy, and they'll sort of present her as in a freelance basis to represent the brand on TV. It's a funny kind of affiliation that happens, and obviously you've got yourself in this. It's sort of an interesting business, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right, yeah, and that there's this this realm of lifestyle expert and spokesperson that comes from working in certain industries. And and definitely with my work with Neighborhood Kitchens is how I was connected and was thought of for the cookbook and to become a spokesperson for the cookbook and to contribute to the cookbook. So I think that, you know, and I know specifically with Cabot, they were looking for someone who works and lives in New England and was familiar with the brand and with the cooperative. And so that's kind of how I got connected. And you're totally right that there is this, and I remember her, and she had Ready, Set, Cook.
Yes.
I really enjoyed her in the early years of Food Network. She was a lot of fun. She's fun.
One thing I'll tell you about Sissy is she's happy that we're talking about her.
Great.
No, Sissy was. She was on, you know, a lot of people grew up because she was sort of on that Ready, Set, Cook, which was sort of a very early version of Chopped. Was on sort of at the dinner hour or when kids came home from school. And, her and Sarah Moulton and some of the classics.
I love Sarah Moulton. Yeah, but... Right. And then you could call in, and ask your questions.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you grew up in New England or Puerto Rico, or what's your story?
I was born in the Bronx, and then I mainly grew up in Ossining, New York, which is in Westchester County on the Hudson River. So that's where I mainly grew up. And then I ended up moving to Providence, Rhode Island for a while. And then now I live in Boston.
But because you have Puerto Rican descent, that's why you feel a connection.
Right. So I wasn't born there. My father was born in San Juan and then moved here, both to the Bronx. And then, and my mother grew up in Springfield, Mass. And then the two of them met. And then so then we lived in New York. And so on the dinner table, it was, a wide variety. We had Puerto Rican comfort food dishes and then American and some things with a little Polish and French influence with the food that we had. So it was a good variety growing up with that.
Did you get TV training?
TV training? Well, I was working on neighborhood kitchens.
Yeah, or before that, or where'd you go to college?
Oh, I went to New York University, and I did study drama there. But most of my training was actually theater there. And then I did take some TV training courses and workshops after I left with different casting directors after I left school. And so I had some training in that capacity. And then once I started working on neighborhood kitchens, it's just like there's nothing like learning when you're on the job and getting familiar with how everything works.
How'd you get that job?
Through a casting director, actually. A casting director in Boston thought I would be a good match and set me up with a meeting with the producer of the show, and that they were coming up with a new show. And then I had to present a restaurant review, talk about a social or political event happening, and do an on-camera interview. And then subsequent to that, I had a lot more on-camera kind of trials and discussions with the producer. And then, and then other executive producers kind of weighed in, and that's how I ended up starting.
Do you have any other gigs that are similar to this cookbook? Where you're like a lifestyle brand rep?
Not currently. I don't have anything right now lined up for that.
How are you making a living?
I make a living through different things. I do different on-camera projects. I do like film and video. I do quite a bit of theater. I'm in a production of City of Angels, a musical right now in Boston. So I piece together different projects like that.
I know this is probably not the interview you expected, but I just think it's just such an interesting to me. Because I'm always talking about different parts of the business of publishing and food, and there's a woman I know who basically speaks for, I think, Forbes, and she's a personal finance expert, but she doesn't really work for Forbes. But every time. But they love, because she's young and she's good looking and she knows how to speak on TV, and those are all great things. And she every time that she manages to get a story on a morning show, she gets a check for like $5,000 from Forbes, because it's like free. It's better than advertising because you're within the show itself. Just a funny part of the business. I'm not trying to suggest there's anything untoward about it. Because the question is, who actually wrote this Cabot book? And we're talking about, just to remind people, it's the reason we're even having this interview and why I'm doing it for New Books and Food is it's the Cabot Creamery Cookbook. Why don't you tell us the basics of the Cabot Creamery? Is the Cabot Creamery?
What is the Cabot Creamery? So it's Cabot Creamery is Cabot Cooperative. It's the brand of Cabot Cooperative, which is an almost 100-year-old cooperative, dairy farm cooperative. that started right outside of Cabot, Vermont, which is where it gets its name from. And today it's made up of 1,200 farm families, and they're across New England and upstate New York. And just like the name cooperative implies, it's 100% owned by farm families, and they share 100% of the profits. So the creamery part of it is taking the milk from these 1,200 farm families and making the products that we're familiar with from Cabot, which are the cheeses, the cheddars, the butters, their yogurts, and all different types of dairy products. So that's Cabot Cooperative. And then this is their cookbook, which was published, like I said, Time Inc. and Oxmoor House Books. So the way that it was kind of put together was an editor, a cookbook editor from Time Inc., Oxmoor House Books, kind of, you know, there was an editorial staff that oversaw the production of the book. But these recipes that are in here, many come from the farmers themselves, and the cookbook itself has 16 farm family profiles, so you can get a real inside look into what it's like to be a dairy farmer today, and people who have 50 cows to 2,000 cows from Maine all the way down to Westerly, Rhode Island. And so there's all these profiles, and then each one of those farmers that are profiled supply at least one of their recipes that they serve to their families, to workers on the farms. It's also a reality of dairy farming today that a lot of these farms have other businesses, so bed and breakfast, dairy stores, bakeries. And then the additional recipes come from chefs that use Cabot products, such as Chef Joshua Rollins, Chef Jimmy Kennedy, employees, and then Cabot fans such as myself, and Grace Potter of Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. She's a musician, and that's a band, and she's from Vermont. So, and then also people who have just submitted their recipes over the years to Cabot. And Cabot has been compiling recipes for years and years. So this is kind of the greatest hits. There's 150 recipes from appetizers to desserts that Cabot has been compiling. So the recipes come from all those different sources through Cabot. And then Time Inc. Oxmoor House Books is who put it together and took the photography and put together.
They're what you call a book packager.
I guess so. I don't know if I would necessarily call it a book packager, but yeah, I mean, they're the ones that are responsible for putting it all together and setting the tone for it and things like that.
Did Cabot want to do a cookbook and came to them, or Oxmoor Time was looking for a project and dreamt this up?
Oxmoor Time actually approached them. Cabot is... Cabot's been approached many times to do it, and they've also wanted to do it, and then it was just a matter of resources and timing working out, and this is how it all worked out for this cookbook to come out in February.
Right, and, you know, it's an established publishing operation, and so it was probably not too much of a commitment from Cabot to, you know, and then they get this nice-looking book. Here's three recipes I'm just looking at. Yogurt, curry, deviled eggs. Interesting idea, and it uses mostly the milk product is some Greek style yogurt, pepper jack artichoke hummus, which has some pepper jack in it. Guess what?
Yes.
And then there's a farm here. Just looking at the farm at Wheeler Mountain, and a couple of their side business. One of their side businesses. Grass-fed Jersey beef. And they have 250 acres and 100 Holsteins, and there's some nice pictures in here. It's a very slick book. I visited the Cabot factory store a few weeks ago up in – near Stowe, Vermont.
Yes.
And it actually – you know, it's one of those – there's two kinds of factory stores. There's the ones that are bullshit, and there's the ones that are good. And it's funny because this is a good one. And what do you think the difference is between the two?
Oh, I mean, I guess...
In my mind. You're trying to guess my standards.
Yeah, I conjecture that what you mean by the ones that are the factory stores that you don't really enjoy are the ones that it seems like there's no connection to the brand, that it's more just like an outpost and that you... I don't know. I mean, well, I've been to the Cabot factory stores and... You can try all the different types of cheeses, and there's also maple, you know, maple that you can try if you're in Vermont and things like that. So I don't know. Am I close to what you're thinking of? Or
you are, and you are. And the leading indicator, yes, are two things: the amount of samples and the prices. If you're in a factory store, you should be paying at least slightly to a lot less than if you were buying it in the supermarket.
Okay.
And that's because the factory store is not simply this operation trying to, you know, create huge revenue. It's a brand, you know, it's excitement over the brand. It's an advertisement. You know, it's like, oh, you're all the way here where we have these things. And so we're going to bring you in and make you feel something. And the Cabot store that I was at near Stowe, which is the ski resort, is also on the same property. There's a Lake Champlain chocolate store, which I would say is one of the bullshit stores, because you go in there and the chocolate costs at least as much, if not more, than I think it would cost anywhere else. You do have some factory seconds in there, which are like 20 cents cheaper on a $5 bar, and they're sampling almost nothing. And I wanted to try the hot chocolate, and I didn't want to spend $5 on. I didn't want a whole hot chocolate. I wanted to try it, but no.
Right.
But then you go to the Cabot store. They have pretty much every single Cabot cheese there, including the incredibly hot hiccup producing jalapeno. Not jalapeno. What is it?
Habanero.
Hot habanero.
Cheddar, yeah.
Which I think most people could handle it, but if you like hot, get the hot habanero. And you know what else I like there? They have other cheeses that, just because they're sort of trying to showcase what's happening locally, including this great stuff called Bailey Hazen Blue. I don't know if you've ever had that. I strongly recommend anybody run and get some Bailey Hazen Blue. It's similar in some ways to that California's Maytag blue cheese, but it's not too shocking or burning in the throat, but it's just got a really deep, complex flavor that just the thinnest slice is spectacular. Anyway, there's my extolling. And they also sell really good local ciders at the one I went to. So what does everybody ask you about this book?
Everybody asks me where the recipes come from. So we've kind of talked about that already. They ask me about what some of my favorite recipes are and what my experiences are with the farms, if I've ever been to any of them, things like that. So to answer some of those questions.
Well, let's talk about the farms, because Vermont is interesting because there's a lot of quality product happening there, with whether it be the beef that comes from the cows, and there's, you know, a lot of grass fed. The valleys there are so sort of intensely lush because of the snow from the mountains that comes down.
Mm-hmm.
The season can be sort of short. They're making great beers up there, Lawson's, to mention one. What did you notice? And something interesting you said. They're all sort of in two businesses at least.
Yes, that's true. Well, one farm that I visited is Liberty Hill Farm, which is in Rochester, Vermont. And I was there in January, and they have a thriving bed and breakfast business. And so Bob and Beth Kennett own the farm, and Bob and his sons manage the 150 cows, milking cows that they're working with. And then Beth runs the bed and breakfast, and she does a widespread for both breakfast and dinner, with all different types of options for people who have different dietary, concerns or what have you. And what I think is interesting is that she decided to start this bed and breakfast, and she has it year round, because a lot of people just do it in the summer and they think people only want to visit the farm in the summer, or perhaps only in the winter, or just in the summer and winter when people are going to be going skiing. And she's had it year round, and it's a pretty successful business, and that she has lodgers for most of the year. And it's people who are interested in visiting farms, some school groups, families. And so people who want to go be in Rochester, Vermont, and then they'll drive to Sugarbush Mountain and go skiing, or they'll hang out on the farm and get tours and get the opportunity to milk the cows and get a real understanding of what it is to be on a farm. And so in her spreads and some of the recipes that are featured are her Greek style yogurt and fruit pancakes. She's also got a turkey pot pie. And what I thought was really interesting about that is that I always think of it with a pastry crust, but in Vermont, it's a biscuit top. So she makes a cheddar biscuit top that she puts it on her pot pie.
It's just interesting, you know, and in a way this book is just a good example of how food, there's just so many different potential businesses that can spin off it, not just restaurants, you know, not even just farming. There's just one interesting thing about Liberty Hill Farm, if you see the photo in the book, which is 74, it looks like what you think a farm should look like. It's got a really nice red barn that has a nice spire on it. It's sort of got some verdant area. It's there's a river running up next. I don't know if that's the Mad River, but and so it's sort of well poised to be. I'm sure the people who originally made the farm weren't thinking it was going to become a bed and breakfast, but it just happens to have evolved that it looks just right for that kind of thing.
Right, and that you would want to visit it. It's the idea of like, oh, I want to go to a New England farm. And like you said, it's just kind of almost like the dictionary picture that would be there with the red farm that's, you know, over 100 years old, the barn. And yeah, and it's very lush. I was there and it was -8 degrees and covered in snow. So it looks completely different than this picture here in the cookbook. But you can see how lush it is in Vermont in the summers.
People ought to, by the way, not just Sugarbush, but Mad River Glen, great place to ski. Old school. Mm. Have you gone there?
No, I haven't.
It's like skiing in 1951. If that sounds good to you, then you should check it out. It's really just a beautiful timepiece, you know, stuck in time in the best possible way.
Right.
And no snowboards.
And no snowboards. Oh.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I just feel like that's rare these days. Something you also mentioned about different businesses, along with even just farms being off of it, and what's also featured in the cookbook are there are different, you know, there's a lot of cow power about using manure in order to, you know, supply other alternate resources for power and fuel and things like that. And then also there's one farm that they have a side business of cow pots, which are globally sold, and that's Freund's Farm. And what they are, you know, little pots that are biodegradable, and you have your seedlings in them, and then you can just plant them right into the ground. So it's really interesting in how a lot of these different farms have different entrepreneurial endeavors, like you said, but beyond just food or dairy stores.
Why do you think that if you're driving up one of those highways from upstate New York and then you cross over into Vermont, that on the New York side, it looks like ramshackle, poverty-stricken Appalachian hell, and then in Vermont, it just becomes charming? How did that happen?
I don't know.
Do you agree? Go ahead, agree.
Yeah, I know
you do.
It's been a while since I've gone from upstate New York to Vermont, so I can't say that I can actually attest for that. But I've been in different areas where it's sometimes you pass over from one section of, let's say, yeah, that there's kind of ones that look very poverty stricken in either New Hampshire or other parts of Vermont. Yeah. And you come into, oh, and now we have quaint farms and rural and cottages and things like that, and or in a little town with the main street, and you see that right next to each other. And I do agree with that. But I don't know what the difference is, and why.
It's got to be something to do with with government or something. I know upstate New York is having a lot of drug problems, and I'm sure Vermont does too. But probably New York it's heroin, and Vermont is pot. So those have different results. Now I want to provoke you and ask which one of these is best if you add pot to it, but, recipes, what, besides more, are you going to make any more of this television show, or do you think that's had its run?
That's had its run for these two seasons. Mm-hmm.
What do you think if you could have your next food opportunity, what would it be? Your sort of business, television, media, you know, showbiz, whatever.
Well, I'd love to do, I mean, what I really loved about Neighborhood Kitchens and working on it is I love working on programs and different projects that have an educational bent. And so that was something that I really enjoyed sharing and researching and working on, with just as far as sharing the history of different neighborhoods and how they've changed culturally over the years and what and where we are today and how people can access that through food, and also tips and how things cannot be, you know, cooking doesn't have to be, I think for some people they find it intimidating and that it isn't. So I really, in the future, I would love to be in something and that incorporates an educational component and about the history of certain ingredients of different things that we have on our table or that might not be as familiar in certain areas as far as ingredients and what the history of it and how it is typically used. So those are kind of things that I...
Do you go back to... Do you ever go... No, go back. Do you go to Puerto Rico and travel around?
I have. I haven't been in probably about 8 years. The last time I was there, though, I was there for about a month. And so I do really like... going there and traveling around. And I think that there, you know, it's a very small island and yet you go around to all these different cities across the island and it's they're so different. I mean, there's ones like Rincón, which is really known for its surfing, and you go there and you can get away with speaking English because it's just, there's so many tourists and so many people going there for the beaches and for the surfing. And then you go down, one of my favorite cities is Ponce, which is kind of more southern. And it's a beach town and it's pretty small, but it's got a really great museum. And it has, I feel like, a diversity of styles and approaches to art and things like that. And then you go to Mayaguez, which is where the main university is, and or one of the main universities are, and that's a little more, you know, bookish in a way. But once again, it's right on the water, so there's really great surfing and beaching. So
what do
I think
surfers want to eat?
What surfers? I like seafood. You know, they want to eat what's coming out of the ocean. And I think, but nothing fussy, you know?
No, I think they also want to eat, like, giant multi-level sandwiches.
Mm.
Surfing takes a lot of energy. I mean, serious energy. Because your body's trying to stay warm in the water, and it's constant paddling, and it's a very intense sport.
Yeah.
You know, I think the thing, one of the reasons I was asking about Vermont and how it looks and stuff, there's a style to food in a lot of places, and... You know, the food does, you know, there's no reason why in New York you shouldn't be able to get good Mexican food everywhere, but you really can't. Places it's okay, but, you know, the average taco truck on any street in Los Angeles is better than the best taco at any restaurant in New York. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because there's just a culture, there's an understanding of, you know, what's supposed to be in it. And I think also in New York, there's this sort of, even though there's a lot of Mexican immigrants here now, there's a lot of sort of misunderstanding that, like, people from the Caribbean aren't Mexicans. I hate to say that, but, like, and there's just a lot of just general Hispanic people making Mexican food. And that's, you know, that'd be like, well, any comparison you can make. It's not, it's a different mm-hmm. cuisine. And I think there's something to Vermont with, you know, what's put on the plate there. And I think, you know, I do think that the cookbook, you know, with the art in it, it does capture a sort of simplicity and yet sort of authenticity. There's not a lot of fake stuff in here. Even though it's simple, it's real. And I think there's something, mm-hmm. just having gone to Vermont a lot in recent years and skiing, you know, the best hamburger I've ever had may have been at a ski resort there. And it was because it was this grass-fed beef and the farmer had actually it was at Mad River, and the farmer it's a cooperative there also. And the farmer's like a member of the cooperative. And so it just is, there's something, you know, really, I hate using the word amazing because everyone uses the word amazing with food now. It's amazing. The corn is amazing. It's like, yeah, they grilled it and they put salt on it. It was amazing.
And it's amazing.
But it's, the truth is always on the plate, and there's also a place. I don't think there's any recipes in here from there, but there's a place in Waitsfield called Mad Taco.
Oh, I've been there. Yeah.
That's some serious. See, those are good tacos. Why? Because they're not only trying to reproduce the Mexican taco, it's a Vermont taco. And it's good.
It's its own thing. Uh-huh. And they have, probably 100 different hot sauces,
yeah.
Which I think is great. Like, because you can try all different ones, like you were saying before, you want to try a bunch, like you don't want to be committed to it. So, you can try all the different ones there. There might not have 100, it's probably about 25, but yeah. A good amount for making your own hot sauces that have all different types of chilies and peppers in them.
And there's so many great microbrews around there. And I think Lawson's is probably mm-hmm. the top of the list, but a Vermont taco and a beer are a really nice match. I would recommend it to anybody.
Yes, absolutely.
So what is the idea of where this book is supposed to be sold?
It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and available in Barnes & Noble's and a lot of different big chain bookstores, and then also, just being in where I am in Boston, a lot of the smaller retailers have them as well, and all across Vermont and New England, small bookstores have been having events with farmers and signings and things like that, and some demonstrations. So I think, what I like about the cookbook also is that the ingredients aren't too hard to come by. That they're very it's focused on ones that you can readily get in your supermarket.
Why do you think people feel there is a sort of, sometimes people don't like big brands and, mm-hmm. I think even Ben & Jerry's for some reason, by the way, the Ben & Jerry's factory is not so far from a lot of the Cabot stores, or at least the one I was at. And,
right.
It is actually, the ice cream is actually slightly better at the Ben & Jerry's factory than it is from one of those pints at the supermarket. And also, they give you a lot for a reasonable price, I will say. But there is, even towards Ben & Jerry's, a little bit of sort of skepticism that this has become a giant brand and, maybe it's not, it ain't Jenny's or whatever the favorite $12 pint is now. But Cabot does seem to have a sort of, even though the cheese is not the most gourmet, it's generally pretty simple stuff, mm-hmm. people kind of have a warm spot for it.
Yeah, I think, and that's the heritage of it. And they actually do have a wide range. So there are, there's your everyday cheeses that you would have, like the Monterey Jack or your New York Sharp or Vermont Sharp. And then they've got some other cheeses that are a next level up, like the legacy cheeses. And then up from there, like I really enjoy their private stock cheddar, which I think is great to have, on a cheese plate. But then they've got their cloth bound cheddar cheese, which is with Jasper Hill, and it's, aged in a cave, and that's $25 a pound. And it's really, and that's the one of their most award winning cheddars that they do international and national competitions that they win with. So there is a wide range, but I think the ones that we're most familiar with are the ones that are readily available in our supermarkets. And I think it comes back to the cooperative, and just that it's a brand that comes from a cooperative. And so you can depend on the cheese being of a good quality. And it's also, you're supporting New England and upstate New York farmers when you are purchasing the Cabot product. And there's a real commitment to excellence. And something, when I am on a visit that I had in January to the Cabot administrative offices, I met with a cheese grater, and he kind of led me through what he does with it. And what I thought was interesting
that's a cheese grader, like as if you were getting a grade in school, not somebody professionally grates cheese on
cheese
a metal
on their metal. Yeah, great. Exactly. A cheese grater. And he led me through the process of what they do. And he'll go to different creameries, try the cheeses as they're being aged. And it's not just, for instance, we have a cheddar. We're going to age it for 3 months and then put it in a 3-month package of our, Vermont cheddar. No, what it ends up doing is he'll test it at a certain point and then be like, this needs to age for a few more months. This needs to age for a little less. Or, you know what? I think this needs to age for quite a few months more in order to be at the 9-month mark for their Artisan Reserve or for one of their legacy cheeses. So it's about testing it the whole way and deciding when does this meet the what we're going to package in it and how we send it out. So I think it's those two things. There's a real commitment to excellence and knowing what you're going to be, what they're going to put forth in selling supermarkets, and then also the cooperative where all of these farmers are coming together to produce a good product and share in the resources that to make it and to use it to live on.
Let me ask you the most important question. It's going to be the last one, I think. Your name is Margarita Martinez.
Yes.
Therefore, you must have a special margarita that you make.
Oh, I actually don't like margaritas.
Why?
I don't really like tequila, I have to say. I've had some... Yeah, and so if I were to do one, there's sometimes...
No, forget it. That's it. You don't like them.
I know.
Is it that tequila drives you wild and you've done crazy things under its influence?
No, it's not that. It's the taste of it. There's something about tequila. I've had better tequilas and I find them more palatable, but no. If I'm going for a cocktail, it's more the vodka persuasion. I love a good cosmopolitan. I love a good martini.
Vodka persuasion. I mean, vodka has no taste.
Yeah, but well, no. I mean, they have different flavors I think there's a difference.
I know people the vodka.
Yeah, but actually, no. If I were to choose, it would be gin, and I think that has full flavor.
Sure.
But what about
the book, The Master and Margarita?
Oh, I haven't read that one yet.
You are not embracing your name. I have to.
No. I have a picture of a daisy on my credit card. That's what my name means in English, so I'm embracing that.
You were given something. You got to run with it. If I was going to rebrand you, I would have you be more margarita-ish.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is great talking to you. Margarita Martinez, she is the person who is talking about a cookbook called The Cabot Creamery Cookbook, Simple Wholesome Dishes from America's Best Dairy Farms. I'm Alan Salkin. This is New Books in Food, and I hope you had a good time. Thanks.
I did too. I did have a good time. Thanks.
This is New Books in Food, part of the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com, where there are interviews with authors on every subject you can imagine. It's a great site. Check it out to find recipes and other material related to what we talked about today. Check out cookbooks.about.com. The about.com website for which I am the cookbooks and food writing expert. My website is alensalkin.com, A-L-L-E-N, S like Sam, A-L-K-I-N. All my social media is Alan Salkin. Also, Instagram, Facebook is facebook.com/Salkin. Twitter is Alan Salkin. I think you can find me. Guess what? My name's Alan Salkin. Thanks for listening.